Welcome to Opera Out of the Box, unpacking opera piece by piece. I'm your host, Brad Cresswell, and today we're looking at how war affects art and how art influences war. All questions hopefully will be answered today by our special guests. I have Dr. Adam Levine, who is the director of the Toledo Museum of Art, and the general director of Toledo Opera, James Norman. We also have Toledo Opera's development officer, Leah Whitaker, who has done all the research for this episode, so kudos to you, Leah.
I did art therapy in college.
I have a fanfare for all of you. No, I promise there aren't going to be any more music or any more quizzes or anything like that, because we have a very serious discussion.
Very serious.
We've talked about love and war. We've talked about love with Giacomo Puccini's opera Tosca, and war with South Pacific of Rodgers and Hammerstein. And we're focusing today on how war and art go together, for lack of a better term. And I was looking at the questions here, and I was thinking of the artist, because I was an artist at one time. I was a singer, you know, an opera singer for many years. And how far should they go or be allowed to go in making a political statement with their art, making a statement against war or protests, that sort of thing? So that is a general question for all of you to answer. Jim, let's start with you.
Well, I think engaging with war in the arts today is a complex and powerful undertaking, especially as artists, and we as cultural leaders navigate the often charged emotional and political terrain of contemporary conflicts. I mean, it's a very political thing that we as nonprofits try to stay out of, but museums and opera companies and other cultural institutions can serve both spaces of reflection and platforms for dialogue, which we've tried to do with our arts and our, you know, companion programming, so that, you know, we can help to shape the public discourse about war in meaningful ways. Like I said, we've been doing the companion program, such as this podcast, and our panel discussions that Leah mentioned with all of the different things. And for South Pacific, we presented both the American and the Asian viewpoints by hosting U.S. veterans and a Japanese internment camp survivor and a war bride to discuss their experiences. So I think we as artists can talk through our art. It's not as upfront with, you know, we're not on the corner honking and having signs of protest, but we can, through the different art forms that we have, visual arts and the performing arts, can make a difference.
Toledo Opera should do that honking horns on the corner thing. Definitely.
Oh, we would do something.
Only if we could
way
do it in melodies.
Than that. Yeah, exactly. It'd have to be in harmony.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Levine, can I call you Adam? That's okay.
I hope you will.
Yes. Okay, Adam, let me ask you a similar question. I mean, and in terms of Toledo Museum of Art, I mean, war sells. I was struck by something that Leah said before we got on mic, talking about how everybody's attracted to the idea of war. I'm curious what Toledo Museum of Art has in the way of war exhibits. I mean, they've got some very famous ones. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how that works with Toledo Museum of Art.
Yeah, look, it's a great question. And I think that there are sort of two components to the answer to also build off of what Jim said. You know, on the one hand, there's a question about how you engage contemporary art that is responding to conflict in the world at this moment, which sort of Jim addressed. But your question, I think, is more focused on sort of the permanent collection, the historical collection, and maybe other temporary exhibitions that we've done that touch on the theme of war. So I'll sort of push in that direction first, and we can follow up as needed. War is a conflict between people and civilizations is pretty fundamental to the human civilizational experience. I think if I'm remembering my archaeology right, the first evidence of war, I think, comes from 13,000 BC in Egypt. And as soon as people become sedentary and start claiming turf and resources to support expansion, there's conflict. So highly correlated with the emergence of agriculture and sedentary populations, you end up with conflict. So for millennia, we've seen war. And for much longer, we've seen art. art is fundamental to the human condition. So it goes without saying that in an institution that collects 6,000 years of human history across six continents, we've got a lot of artwork that relates to warfare. And incidentally, vestiges of warfare or conquest show up in artwork. So there are some paintings like that quite literally depict warfare, like Antoine Jeanrenaud showing a battle scene on the Battle of Eylau. And then there are works like our Gandharan Bodhisattva that show from Pakistan, India, right, from sort of that sort of region of the world, show a figure wearing what looks like a almost diaphanous Greek Roman toga or sort of Greek vestment. And that shows the influence of Hellenistic art as Alexander, right, pushed the Hellenistic Empire that far east. So, you know, war is absolutely fundamental to art history because it's fundamental to history. And I'm sure we'll unpack more, but, you know, as for that very reason, you find war throughout the Toledo Museum of Art Collection. I would also say on the temporary exhibition side of things, we have not done an exhibition that is expressly about war, but the exhibition we've done in my tenure that most closely relates to it is, of course, the exhibition that we did on Arms and Armor. Showcasing, of course, you know, things that were worn into battle, more ceremonial, but things that were designed right for battle, and you know, magnificent works of art, but directly related to ideas of conflict.
I feel like we just had a history lesson,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Our history lesson.
I have a very philosophical follow-up to that because this is a very exciting conversation for me. So, in my sort of imagination, war happens because expression, human expression, peaceful expression reaches its limits. And we can look at that like in political terms, like that would be diplomacy sort of reached its limits. Therefore, war is sort of the next escalation. In the terms of like the relationship with art and war, do you think that art has a limit in human expression? Can art as a function or a tool serve in a diplomatic fashion that would prevent war? And this wasn't on our question list, but I'm wondering, you know, this is all really about human expression, and in the development of human civilization, war is actually an essential tool of transmuting culture and history. Like, it's actually essential to art development, and I would assume art is also. So do both of those sort of functions in human history have their limits? Like, or do you as men of the arts think that, you know, like this is the way to go? Like, we should practice more human expression through artistic means.
So, a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
That's a great question.
Yeah, just
well.
Hit me.
Yeah, so the first thing I would say is war. I would contend, because I want to live in a society that doesn't have war, that war is not essential. Conflict probably is essential to the human condition. And I also think that sometimes war is not a last resort. I do think there are instances in history where it's used, proactively, with devastating effect. So which is sort of just to frame that, you know, ideally there would be no war.
Yeah.
But war does have a secondary consequence of diffusing ideas, which is, I think, what you were sort of getting at. And that is what I was sort of describing with, Alexander's conquest eastward, right? And the residual formal and stylistic influences that you see in Gandharan art. And there are myriad other examples. But there are a lot of examples at the Toledo Museum of Art of artworks that were created as diplomatic gifts, including, quite recent acquisition of this remarkable Safavid carpet, so made in sort of 16th century Persia, but likely would have been made for export. We actually have something, a taza, a glass, that we know was given. It's a fascinating object, which we think is Turkish glass and French gold.
Ooh.
That was probably given by the Ottoman emperor to Lord Kelsing, the Norwegian, I believe, diplomat.
You have such a fun job.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. So,
you do.
So art does serve this function of diplomacy. It can calcify imagery around war and can act as a physical residue of those, that osmosis of ideas that sort of you've discussed. But I think it is also sort of embedded in that question is something I'm sure we'll get to later on, which is when art can be used in the service of the state engine around war, which obviously gets closer to propaganda.
Right.
So there's also a teasing out, I think, which is important as we evolve, as we elaborate this conversation between art and visual culture or visual communication.
Okay.
Because I think art is fundamentally different in the way that the artist is using his or her or their creative act.
Okay.
Visual communication is more
selling.
Well, it's more didactic. Mm-hmm. It's less about the creation of a feeling.
Okay.
And it's why it stirs less.
Good Lord.
Well, and I think the audience has to come into that as well, because if the audience is more open to the ideas and the change, they're going to be more moved by a painting, an opera, whatever. But if they're very shut down and they're just, okay, entertain me, whatever, they're not going to be as open to that.
Mm-hmm. So you're seeing more of like there's even a fourth dimension when we talk about these creative expressions that includes those who receive.
Absolutely.
The art
I can
form
walk
itself.
Into the museum and see, oh, that's a pretty painting. But if I don't know the history behind it and I'm not engaged enough to look into that, how much has that changed me?
Right.
Same thing with any, you know, performing arts. Okay, that was great. I clap. But is it really into my soul, and am I thinking about it on the way to the car?
Right.
I was going to ask you, Jim, how does this stuff that Adam has been talking about, how does it filter into the world of opera? Because there are a lot of examples of operas in wartime and musicals in wartime. You did one recently. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about opera and war as it relates to, you know, what you do.
Well, I think throughout history, there's been a lot of societal comments, let's say that, by composers. You know, with Tosca, there was the Napoleonic Wars. They talked, you know, there's fighting against, Cavaradossi and his friend Angelotti are both fighting against what Baron Scarpia really wants with Rome and the Napoleonic Wars. With South Pacific, you know, everyone thinks of Rodgers and Hammerstein as these light, fluffy musicals of Sound of Music and, you know, King and I and things like that. But they all have a very, very pointed message in them. South Pacific happens to be about not only war, but race. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yes, they're, you know, you're having fun with some of the numbers, but there's a lot of pointedness that composers can get into. When you look at Verdi's Rigoletto, he was really not happy with, I think it was King Francois. King Francois, from what I understand, was not the nicest of men and a lech. And so Verdi was going to make comments about this in Rigoletto, but really couldn't do it because of state censorship. Mm-hmm. So he changed the king to a duke and changed it from France into Mantua. So, you know, we skirt the issue by not going exactly and naming the person so that we can get around the state censors, which were very big back then.
Well, in those classic operas that you like, you know, Verdi and Puccini, I mean, they were also the composers and librettists themselves were at a certain part of society that had, you know, a little bit more access and knowledge of the people who ran the government and the state. So they had probably had to be a little bit more
censored.
Well,
a lot of them had patrons in the royal families or government that, you know, they had to please.
Right. So it's like opera seems to always be walking a tight line.
Absolutely.
It really is a careful.
I think painters and sculptors had a little more,
yes and no, right? I mean, I think there are examples, certainly. I mean, the ones that come to mind have less to do with war, but there are certainly examples, including Michelangelo and the Sistine Ceiling, right? Including sort of veiled imagery about his patron, you know, Julius II. But, you know, I it is a reminder as well that some of the most sophisticated messaging comes out of places that have high degrees of censorship. So it's certainly the case now in certain countries, right, that there are incredibly rich, flourishing artistic cultures and subcultures, even in places with really significant censorship, because the artists there have figured out ways to say things without saying things.
Yeah, that's a fair. It's very interesting. I'd love to hear some examples, but it does.
Well, I don't want to get them in trouble.
Oh, okay.
but you can imagine, sure, the types of places, right?
Right. Absolutely. And I think that it never occurred to me that, you know, in a liberal sort of free democratic society where you do have strong First Amendment rules and you can protest and do all these other forms of expressive release or community conversations, in a very restricted society where those outlets are not at your everyday disposal, or you couldn't even have conversation with your friend at the market, that, you know, the isolated work of creating something does really, it does magnify that powerful thing.
No, it's just, it's a subtler form of variation. And in fact, you know, one of the places I think Jim and I, you know, it wasn't a question, but one of the places where that type of messaging also intersects, or that type of messaging might play out, and I don't know, that's beyond the scope of my expertise, is in costume and set design.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm quite certain that when we think about the words that were expressly used in a Verdi opera, that's very important, of course, right? That's the music. But there were also quite intentional decisions, mm-hmm, about how it would have been performed, mm-hmm, how it would have been situated in relation to your earlier point, Jim, of a specific audience.
Correct.
Right? And those all carried cues as well about what was intended around these things. So the visual arts are not divorced from opera, nor is opera, right, divorced from the visual arts. You know, again, I can think of great examples of set and costume design, right, by very significant artists. I am not expert enough to know how that plays out in operas related to war,
right,
but I am certain that there must have been some visual messaging as well.
The production design always goes hand in hand.
Right.
So if you're moving it from France to Mantua, you're obviously going to have a different style of costumes and setting and, mm-hmm, everything like else. You know, and it, I think that, you know, when you go to famous artists like Chagall, who did a whole series of,
yes,
things at the Met for the Magic Flute, I don't remember. I don't think his hangings are still in the lobby. But, you know, you've got famous people that do that, and it does give it a different look. It depends,
hugely,
on whether, you know, right now on Broadway, we were just talking before we went on air about the opening of Othello with Denzel Washington.
And, mm-hmm,
that is a contemporary piece of Shakespeare, but they've put it so that it's in 2025 in, you know, uniforms of the current period. Which to some audiences is jarring that you're not seeing Shakespearean, but it does give it a whole different feel.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. It makes it much more relevant now than it would if you were in, you know, Bodkins and all of that kind of thing.
Yes.
Well, Brad, this is a great conversation. One of our best.
I was curious about what Adam said, mentioning propaganda, and I wonder if, you know, there's some kind of correlation between the music world. You think of, like, Shostakovich, for instance, who had this thing going on where he was always, you know, poking fun at the establishment without them knowing it, hopefully. And I wonder, Adam, if there is art that was created as propaganda, that kind of thing, if you have any examples of that, or if you can talk about it in general.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think propaganda is it's a very, I mean, we could have a philosophical conversation about what constitutes propaganda, right? So I think, generally speaking, back to this point of audience cognizance, you know, propaganda is can be for a narrow audience, but I think propaganda is, generally speaking, a tool of the state and is therefore used with populist aims.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most controversial example that I could offer, because art historians still can't decide whether or not they like the works as art, or Norman Rockwell's Four Freedoms.
Mm.
Right. So I think that I don't know that that is frequently brought up in conversations about propaganda. Right.
Can you describe that image?
Yeah. So actually, four separate images,
okay,
that were commissioned for the Saturday Evening Post over, okay, four successive weeks. The image that is most famous for everyone is what you would think of as the American Thanksgiving scene.
Yeah.
right? Mm-hmm. But they were actually an allusion to a speech that Franklin Delano Roosevelt gave about these four freedoms that should be preserved by the U.S. war effort.
Oh, okay.
Right. So they're not frequently associated with the war effort, but they are kind of these iconic images of Americana, mm-hmm. right? That sort of depict, right, freedom of religion, freedom from want, right? Mm-hmm. And the idea was that engaging in this conflict in the United States would preserve those freedoms.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not in our collection, right? They're in the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. So I don't know that we have much in our collection that I would term sort of propaganda, with maybe one exception that I'll come back to. Certainly state sanctioned, but not necessarily. I think in the ancient world it's maybe a little bit more complicated. So I don't want to commingle things, but I think an example that people could relate to show how complicated the idea of propaganda is are the Norman Rockwell Four Freedoms paintings, because they really touch something, right? Some ideal about what it means to be American. And I think we can sometimes think about propaganda as like this far off thing. And I think actually Norman Rockwell is like a very capable, right? Was a very capable artist. But that's just to sort of belie the complications of talking about this topic. But within the Toledo Museum of Art collection, so now moving to things that are more abstract because they're so deep in time, probably the best examples of propaganda in our collection are, and it's a limited collection relative to some other places, is our collection of ancient coins.
Oh.
Yeah, so numismatics are sort of a great vehicle for ancient propaganda because it was the distribution mechanism for any image you want to almost anyone that you wanted. The obverse and the front and the reverse, right, allow you to not only show two different things, but show two things that can relate to each other, so actually can have some storytelling component potentially brought together by the inscriptions. So coins were an incredible vehicle for propaganda or propagandistic messaging.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the way that public sculpture was commissioned also served a similar function.
Well, I have a question about that. Can a war memorial, I know they're separate, completely separate functions, but can a war memorial be also viewed as a propaganda tool in that it memorializes, you know, this nationalistic or patriotic, you know, and I guess it's a very narrow view of propaganda, probably based on a post-World War II American experience of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sometimes, like, when you go to war memorials, you kind of feel conflicted about, you know, I don't know, one could have an emotional conflict of paying tribute to those who have sacrificed for American freedom, but also not agreeing with, you know, the function of war. Like you were saying, it's not essential to culture.
Yeah. I mean, this is what a bit of why I opened up with the Four Freedoms, right? I think propaganda can sometimes be defined by the counterparty. So it's just to say, you know, if you're in civilization A and you're in conflict with civilization B, then civilization B's art might be your propaganda.
Okay.
Right, there is a bit of a reassessment, reappraisal going on right now of sort of Soviet realism, and Soviet realism as art. There are people who are sort of working on that right now. So the only other thing I'd say, Jim, before like kicking it over to you, I think in any act of so clearly that like this is not my expertise, right? Mm-hmm. And so disclaimer. But
none of us here is an expert.
No, but in any determination of artistic merit, one has to look at the intention of the artist.
Okay.
And I think rather than creating this category of war memorial, because you've already identified there can be a war memorial that commemorates a war, there can be a war memorial mm-hmm. that commemorates an abstract idea, there can be a war memorial that commemorates an individual or mm-hmm. a set of individuals who mm-hmm. lost their lives. So there are a lot of different types of war memorial.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I would ask the question, to what extent has the artist's intent been subordinated by the state in the service of state aims as a fundamental question about whether or not the category propaganda would apply? And I think that's probably harder to tease out than we might think
in some cases. The Confederate general statues would fall into that category. But Jim, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, for an example, in the opera world, Wagner
Okay.
In World War II, Hitler corrupted all
Hitler's
the Wagner operas.
Yeah, composer.
Yeah, exactly.
I was actually going to ask about Wagner.
So you get thou, and still in some churches for weddings, you cannot use Lohengrin's Wedding March.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, that
yeah.
is something that still is ingrained in 2025, 80 years post World War II. But and it's not
true.
That Wagner wrote those operas
right.
to be of war.
No, not
effect
yeah.
at all. I mean.
But
they're based
co-opted.
On fantasies.
Yeah.
They just, you know, it was his favorite composer, and he would use the De Valkyrie ride through many, many of his speeches and things.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that a composer like Richard Wagner would be very happy that Hitler liked him, right? I mean, he was a willing participant in the whole process, I would say.
He wasn't suing people for using their music at rallies, let's say that.
Yeah. But are people as engaged today as they were back in the day? You know, we hear Adam talking about all this history that goes into an object. I wonder if people really have that as a general feeling or general knowledge. Are they really that engaged in this day and age?
With what's happening today, you think?
Yeah, yeah.
People being the audience, the composers, the artists, what?
All of the above.
well, I think composers are. I think there are many modern composers right now that are taking things that are happening in the world. And the one that I'm thinking of was commissioned by Washington National Opera in the Metropolitan called Grounded, about a female aviator who became pregnant and was sidelined to a little room in a basement somewhere, and she fought, you know, a war on a joystick because she wasn't allowed to be anywhere else.
It sounds like an opera plot to me.
Exactly. So, you know, I think that contemporary composers are looking at that. We just did Tazewell Thompson and Janine Tesori's Blue in 2022,
right.
which was written before the summer of 2020, but became more poignant after the Black Lives Matter movement of that summer. And was voted Opera of the Year, I believe, in 2021. And we were lucky enough to do it in 2022. But, you know, I think that because of that, people look at what's happening. And there are still, I believe, you know, composers and lyricists and painters and sculptors that look at what's going on and go, this is really moving me to do something, to get into my art, to share it in some manner or form, to help people heal, to help people think, to help people move to action, whatever their intent may be.
Yeah, you know, and so I guess two follow-ups to that. So one is, in sometimes visible ways and sometimes invisible ways. So an artist that comes to mind, in part because we were also talking about World War II, is an artist named Werner Pfeiffer. We have several works in the collection by Werner. He lives in upstate New York now, but was raised in Germany during the Second World War. At that time, paper was scarce. And for that reason, paper was a coveted item. So he makes artist books, and he makes sculptural works out of paper.
Wow.
So his entire artistic practice is conditioned by his childhood wartime experience. And so that wouldn't necessarily be obvious to you by looking at some of the remarkable things that he makes. But so war absolutely has an effect on artistic expression. I think the other thing which is really important is, of course, we're in the privileged position of, you know, having this conversation in the United States of America, which, you know, obviously is going through like a complicated political moment. But we get to leave the studio in Toledo, Ohio, and we don't walk out into a war zone. And there are lots of wars around the world at the moment, right? Not just one. And there are some that get more coverage than others, right? But there are, you know, wars across the African continent, right? I've been spending quite a bit of time in Ethiopia recently. There's conflict in Ethiopia. There's conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo, right? And spilling into Rwanda. There's conflict in Sudan. So just to say, and there are artists in all those places, back to the earlier point. So there are artists writing music, making painting, making sculpture, in all of these places with whatever is available to them. So, you know, it's not the question is a good one, right, about whether the American public is as aware of the breadth of global conflict as maybe they once were. But I can assure you that across the world, right? There are people who are acutely aware of the circumstances in which they find themselves and are creating artistic expressions in response to it, which is almost like trivially obvious, but from the privileged position in which we sit, we can sometimes forget that. Sorry.
So, no, I have a follow-up to that, because one of the things that I learned in my interviews with this podcast and meeting veterans is we talked about trench art. And I had visited a private collector who had all this art, all these artifacts, uniforms, watches, everything from World War II. And he pulled out a watch that had an embellishment and a design, and it had been fabricated out of a casing of a shell casing, right? And I was like, oh, wow. And so it got me thinking about, oh, well, there's a whole term for trench art, and it's people using the materials that they have in their hand to create these embellishments, often passed down to families through the generations as sort of like mementos. When I was like Googling what's trench art, like it's very clearly making a delineation between folk art and like craft and what the sort of elite sort of like, you know, what we would see as a museum. And I think that's all about like Western culture and privilege. But maybe you can help us understand, you know, you as the director of an art museum, do you see a functional difference between somebody making something in the trenches, or like you were saying, in the Sudan and the jungles, maybe using raffia or other parts to like put together a, you know, some sort of weaving project? How do you think there is a distinction? Should we look at these with distinction? Or maybe you can tell us, like, what is the power of that sort of in the trench art, and how does that help the individual?
Yeah. So I think probably the most obvious distinction of work made in war zones, whether in trenches or otherwise, or lack of access to materials that might confer stability to the extent stability is the goal.
Oh,
right.
Like
you know, so some artwork.
That'll last.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right. So some conservationally stable.
Okay.
You know, so some works of art actually aren't meant to last.
Okay.
So we shouldn't assume that that's, you know, the outcome. We have an incredible painting in the museum that alludes to the Second World War by Anselm Kiefer, and it's actually meant to sort of self-destruct over time.
Is it a Banksy? Yeah.
Banksy is obviously an artist that is a popular artist who's caught the imagination of lots of people who comment on war very regularly.
Uh-huh.
But no, it's not a Banksy. It's okay. An Anselm Kiefer. Really remarkable painting called Athanor. But I think the question about I would never make a blanket distinction about any type of art.
Okay.
Right. So I would never say, you know, trench art is less than or trench art is as good as, right? Mm-hmm. What I would say is there is some art that is made in any environment, which is superlative. There is some art that is made in any environment, which is not good. And then there's a lot in between. And the majority is in between. And I am certain there is superlative art that was made in trenches, just as I'm sure there is superlative art being made in Ethiopia today.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that there was bad art being made in the trenches.
Good answer.
Right? And that's not just to be political. It's because, in fact, that is true, right?
Mm-hmm.
So 1 in 3 people in the United States consider themselves an artist of some kind. And that doesn't mean that they paint. It could mean they play the guitar. It could mean that they sing opera, right? So that means 1/3 of our armed forces, right,
mm-hmm.
are artists too, to say nothing mm-hmm. of sort of, you know, what one might find oneself doing to pass the time. So there's a lot of art being made out there, and I can't generalize the U.S. to the global population, but a sample of 350 million is pretty significant.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing there are a lot of artists who make art in service to their country's armed forces
sure.
around the world.
Sure.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's so interesting. Fascinating, really. I wonder if war is good for anything, really, when it comes to art. I mean, you talked about the artist Werner, I can't remember his last
name. Pfeiffer.
Yep. Werner Pfeiffer.
Yep.
And how, you know, being in wartime shaped his childhood and shaped his art all the way through. I wonder if there's anything that comes to mind that war could be good for.
It sells.
Yeah.
It sells tickets. It puts butts in the seat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, I mean, back to sort of what I said to Leah earlier, I will never say war is good for anything, but I think people metabolize their lived experiences regardless of mm-hmm. what happens. And sort of the spin I would put on it is another exhibition that we did. You know, I did all this preparation. I'm not talking about any of the prep I did, right?
No, it is.
I prefer this anyway. We did an exhibition, an artist about a decade ago. His name was Varjan Bogosyan, Varushan Bokosyan, an Armenian last name. And he was a professor at Dartmouth in a bunch of collections, including ours. A shared patron of ours, Mary Wolfe, was a collector of his. And he was really an artist. I mean, he was really, really active in the 50s and 60s. And great friends with all those artists, sort of like a mid-century surrealist, created these incredible sort of installations and vignettes. And again, we have some in the collection from found objects. So we were doing this small exhibition, and Varjan came to Toledo, and the idea was he actually went to the Mommy Antique Mall, and he sourced objects for some of the works in the show. So he was around, and I spoke with him, and he was, you know, I think 89 then, a decade ago. As I said, he was sort of, if you're doing the mental math, you were like, mm-hmm. he was in the scene in the 50s and 60s. People mm-hmm. were probably, listeners were thinking, how old is mm-hmm. he? So he was 89. He's passed away, unfortunately, which means he wasn't just born during the Armenian genocide. He had memories of wow. the Armenian genocide. Jeez. And he ended up at Yale, and he studied with Joseph and Annie Albers, and you know, went on to have this distinguished teaching career and, you know, really, you know, have a following and gallery representation. Anyway, I would see Varjan around, and, you know, for, oh, you know, he was here for a week at a time. And I'd say, hey, Varjan, how are you? And he would always say, I'm terrific. And, you know, this is a decade ago. I'm in my late 20s. I'm a millennial. So angsty millennial in late 20s we equals cynical, oh, right? Okay. So I'm like, terrific. At some point, I'm just like, Varjan, come on. You can't be terrific all the time. Uh-huh. Why, you know, are you actually terrific? And he said, look, Adam, if you've seen what I've seen, yeah. why would you be anything but?
Yeah.
Right? So he made the decision based on the horrors that he saw to control his affect, to control his disposition, to not let small things get in the way. And, you know, he was an incredible guy, and I didn't know him intimately, but it always stuck with me. And so I guess that war is good for nothing, but if it is your grounding, if it is your baseline, right, it probably does make other things seem not that significant.
Yeah.
Jeez. One thing I would like to talk about, you, since we're both directors of an organization, how do you decide if you were to do a show, if you were to do an exhibition with war, like how would you curate that? What would you like to do? And Jim, if you had $1 million, you know, to put on, like what would you want to see? And like how would you choose?
There are contemporary artists. You think yeah. of somebody like Mary Kuyumjan, who is a composer, mm-hmm. and she's writing stuff that's related to the Armenian genocide.
Hmm. Well, there's the opera that's based on the Afghanistan conflict as well, called Fallujah. I think it was written in 2014, mm-hmm. where U.S. forces bombed Fallujah, and it killed scores of civilians. There were talks of war crimes and all of that. And the story follows a U.S. soldier and his experience in that. But the interesting part of it is I thought a contemporary opera would go into more of the battle, more into the ravage of the war. It really then doesn't. It goes mm-hmm. into how it affected him and mm-hmm. affected the people of Fallujah. So it was more the psychological and emotional, which is where I think, you know, opera's been doing that since the beginning of time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It, you know, it hasn't changed over the years. We're still telling stories of the people, their relationships, their interactions, their emotions. And I think art does the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, fundamentally, I think what art is about, right, is art is about an act of creative expression that is embodied, right? So, you know, sound comes from somewhere, right? So it's given form that is intelligible to other people, and that creative act is meant to cause someone to feel a feeling, the mm-hmm. audience to feel a feeling. And the reason you can still watch Tosca and be moved by it is because great art is able to transcend chronological and geographic and cultural boundaries mm-hmm. and cause people to feel the feeling the artist intended them mm-hmm. to feel. And I think that's what artists sort of seek. Mm-hmm. So you asked about our decision-making mm-hmm. apparatus.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the joke that I make is I'm the director of an art museum that is least involved in the curatorial program maybe of any museum in the country, and I'm also more involved than any curator would want me to be. And both things are true simultaneously.
And you're number one. And you're number one in the country, Adam.
we were just rated the number one museum in the country by USA Today, which is obviously, like, very gratifying. But, you know, my joke there is that if we hadn't won, I would have totally trashed the methodology. Now that we've won, I'm gonna lean in all the way into it. It's a wonderful thing, and we're pleased for it. But really, the answer is that's a curatorially driven decision, and the way that we think about our programming has more to do with making sure we have over a 5-year rolling period, every chronology, every geography, and every type of medium represented, because we're in the fortunate position of there is no contemporary museum in Toledo, so we tell all of human history, and therefore we've come up with like a matrix to make sure that we're telling all of human history, and that's why we expand our curatorial team, et cetera. But really, it's a curatorially driven decision, and then it's about slotting things in. So if a curator said, "I'd like to do this exhibition, which is focused on war," then we would absolutely sort of think about the way to slot it in. It's provided that it fit within that rubric and that it was going to be engaging to our audiences and it was going to produce some new insight. We try to be scholarly because we are an educational institution that generates new ideas and knowledge, but we're also not a university. It has to be broadly accessible and it has to be publicly engaging. So that's the needle our curators are trying to thread constantly. And if you're giving out $1 million to pursue ideas, I'd be happy to take it, right?
I think we've misunderstood hypothetical.
We're all terrific in our own way.
Yeah, Brad will write that check.
Right. Thank you,
and Brad. I think from the offer standpoint, we're looking at what we've done in the past. What are those classics that sell and engage?
Yeah.
And can we do them in a meaningful manner that's not just another run-of-the-mill, you know, magic flute?
Yeah.
And also look at contemporary works that we think that is a good fit for Toledo Opera and our audiences, and will they engage? And can we sell a ticket? I mean, unlike the museum, which doesn't have to sell tickets, we have to put butts in the seats and earn some of that production cost back, which is only about, you know, a third that the tickets cover. But I think that's it's tough. You know, we don't have that matrix that, you know, we're going to take a little bit of the 17th century and a little bit of the 18th. We really have to, you know, opera's really, at least in Toledo, we're hitting the 19th and 20th and 21st centuries.
Well, yeah, and your repertoire, I mean, your window is so much more narrow than 2D visual arts.
Yeah, we don't
have operas from 2BC. The mummies.
No. Yeah. Well, and obviously the expense model is very different.
Absolutely.
Right? The expense is hugely different.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, this has been an amazing conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just struck by the difference between how your arts worlds are absorbed by the public. I mean, for you, Jim, opera exists in time and space. It exists, you know, it's fleeting, it's momentary. For Adam in the art museum, a lot of the art is on display, so you can come to it and kind of think about it and see it, right?
I can go see it tomorrow and I'll have a different feeling than when I go see it 2 weeks from now. And that could be something that's in me or what kind of bad day I had or whatever. It gives me a different feeling. But again, you're right. When Sunday matinee comes around at 5 o'clock, it's gone, and that production with those singers, sets, costumes will never be seen again.
Well, you brought up Othello, and it's for that very reason. The average ticket price is, you know, a $380 with $907 like seats, right? I mean, because it's fleeting.
Yeah.
Now, I will say, opera has one huge advantage that we don't have.
Oh,
right?
My God, tell us.
Oh, yeah.
What is it?
And I talk with Zach about it at the Symphony. Your art form's portable.
Right. Right. I mean,
we can move
kind
our,
of
much more portable than ours.
True, singer is portable. Yeah. Sets not so much.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. But
that would be like saying a paintbrush is portable to you, though, because the singer is the instrument. It is the paintbrush that goes with the ensemble. It's put in a costume. It's set again a set. So in a sense, the art form of opera is not portable because it is set. But you can pick up a can of paint and move it and do art elsewhere. So I think there's a difference.
Well, I hear that analogy, but I would push back a little bit. In a way, you're right. But actually the work of art is the score.
Yeah.
Right. True. So, and that is portable, right?
Yes.
So, so the singer is like the light fixture a little bit for us, which is not to minimize singers, right?
No.
Just like they focus the light on it.
That's right. And
how they interpret it is how you light it.
And that's exactly right. And the color and the beam spread, all those things is the
what
life
is the color
the
of the wall behind it? You know, all of that goes into it.
So the same opera can sound very different in different places due to direction. And due to artists' voice, right? But ultimately, that work, which is the score,
it can be reinterpreted.
That moves, right? The thing that the artist created with the paintbrushes can move, with a lot of expensive insurance and a very well constructed crate, and an unmarked truck.
And
they're
a nervous,
never marked
nervous
because
board of trustees.
No. So at this point, we've de-risked it pretty significantly.
Okay.
So the board's pretty comfortable with it. Yeah, I mean. Almost nothing goes wrong, right? The thing, though, that most people in Toledo forget is we did have one work of art stolen in 2006 on the Pennsylvania Turnpike when it was coming back from the Guggenheim Museum because they sent the artwork in a marked truck. So,
did we get it back?
Yeah, because no one can sell looted art. It shows up within... with the Gardner Museum is the exception that proves the rule.
Ooh, yeah.
Generally, it gets, you know, because... As it turns out, thieves are not the smartest people in the world. So if they try to sell it, there's only one of them.
Okay.
So I got an idea of you talking about moving one of your paintings someday.
Okay, go ahead.
No, I don't want to do this on air.
Right. You could do it on the spot.
Well, let's say we do an opera. Could you ever see the art museum looking in your collection of, you know, something to enhance, not the set, but like something to enhance like a discussion? Would you be willing as the, you know, maybe help enhance like what we're doing in some of our, you know, we'll talk about that later. Like
we've
insurance.
Done that before
we've
gone during Romeo and Juliet, the first time in 2014, we took singers. I was actually in costume and read from the folio, the folio, but we had it there, read the Shakespeare, and then we sang what Gounod interpreted that, and that was really powerful.
I'm really glad you did this, Leia, because I never get a chance on the record recorded for the staff to hear how many, every meeting of the day, everyone says, I have an idea for something we can do together, and they only get the yeses. They never see how much I manage.
How you're going to tell them no.
I'm not going to say no. I'm going to say, I won't obligate staff labor.
For sure.
So I think I love the idea of collaborating with partners, and I love the idea of finding artistic synergies.
Yeah.
I think the way something like that could work is let me put you in touch with my relevant teammates.
Perfect, because I was going to ask for some
And context. We are planning exhibitions to 2029 right now, so we can also give you
wonderful
visibility to think about your operatic productions in relation to what we're doing.
We're produced through 2028. Images.
There we go. See?
Look at this.
So the other thing, which is back to one of Brad's questions, is art is art. So we can find connections between most anything, but we should absolutely kick those conversations to our programs team. And the one thing I will do is I will always obligate myself in the service of community. So if I can ever offer a talk that would be meaningful to your audience, you just
let me
know.
Or like a regular podcast.
You know what? For you,
we got him on. We got him on the air.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. All right.
Thanks, Adam.
You've been listening to Opera Out of the Box, a co-production of WGTE Public Media and Toledo Opera, with additional support from Ohio Humanities. You can find previous episodes online at our website, WGTE.org, and of course you can dive into all things Toledo Opera at their website, which is ToledoOpera.org. I want to thank my guests today, Dr. Adam Levine, and of course, James Norman and Leah Whitaker from Toledo Opera. I'm your host, Brad Cresswell, and this has been Opera Out of the Box.